ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen. We're going to bring you our opinion and commentary for today's economic and political events for Tuesday, August 17th, 2021. Good afternoon, Dave.
Good afternoon, Melody.
Yes, I'm doing the program by telephone. Still have some technical issues with my microphone, so I hope you can hear me well.
As long as it's not a rotary.
It's not the rotary. I'm only 39. I don't even know what a rotary is. Or party line.
Well, that it is.
We really have a party line now. We have thousands and thousands and thousands of people listening all at once. But anyway, let's go ahead and go to the gold prices right now. We have the market price and the New York spot price. We have gold down $1.60 at $1,786. Silver's down 21 cents at $23.72. Platinum was down 26 at $1,002. Palladium was down, almost 5%, 118. I guess after that retail sales report came out, we'll talk about that on the first topic of the day. But palladium is 2,570. The USDX today was a little stronger by 0.50 at 93.13. Crude oil was down 0.52 at 66.77. And the paper markets today, we have the Dow down 282 points at 35,343. It was down more than 300 points, but it came back a little bit. S&P was down 31 points at 4,448. The NASDAQ down 137 at 14,656. The 10-year yield on 1.26, not a lot of change there. Asia was negative across the board. It wasn't too bad. The Hang Seng was down the most, almost 2%. Europe, it was FTSE was the only positive one. And, it all comes back to the retail sales, I guess, Dave. And
I think so.
Yeah, so 1.1%. That's how much they fell. Retail sales for the month fell 1.1%, almost four times worse than the estimate. They were looking at a 0.3% decline. And excluding automobiles, sales declined 0.4%. And this is all according to our Commerce Department. But everybody remains positive for that consumer to spend. And, of course, that's from the PNC chief economist. But he added that the spending growth is going to shift from goods to services over the next couple of years. So he's talking about a couple of years limiting growth in most categories of retail sales. So we're just going to go to services. I mean, they'll say anything to justify the decline in retail sales. And this is an important gauge to watch. It is an indicator for our overall economic health. And so, but, you know, we saw the series of government stimulus checks. Shoppers went out and spent. And, hey, we were in the shortest recession ever. A measly 2 months, Dave. So, we're making records everywhere, aren't we?
We'll call this one a bust for sure.
Yeah.
What do they call it? A one-time hit? One-hit band?
Yeah. But they're blaming it all on the auto sector. And they're blaming the auto sector as the major contributor to the inflation surge of 2021. Yeah. Why don't they come out and say exactly what inflation is? But no, they got to find some little scapegoat.
Yeah, really. Well, if they're looking for consumers to excuse me, pick this up anytime this fall, heading into a unique holiday season with the supply chains disrupted as they are. They're in for a rude awakening, Melody. We'll talk later in the program about a newsletter article yesterday, which focused on the downward trends in consumer sentiment and why that's bad for the economy, but good for gold. In any event, you know, I mean, clothing stores also saw near 3% decline. I mean, you got a whole bunch of categories, sporting goods, bookstores, musical instruments, online sales posted a 3% drop. You know, it's all over the map. Now, eating and drinking establishments did see a 38% increase from a year ago. That's not a surprise as more and more restaurants and bars reopened over the past several months. Now, we will see where it goes from here. I mean, you still have Fed officials, more of them, in fact, are conceding that inflation, they've met their 2% inflation mandate. Well, that's kind of a joke. I mean, even you take the government's word for it, it's at 5.5%. How long will they let it go that far above? But when you think in reality, it's actually, you know, closer to 9, 10% using the more accurate methods they used 30 years ago. Well, you know, it's out of sight. But as long as the stock market is going to stay up, as long as all this $120 billion a month can keep propping up, not necessarily the economy, it's the stock market, corporations, and indirectly, you know, in the minds of the Fed, that's what they're doing. They're going to continue to buy all those bonds. But, you know, they still need to see a market improvement in the labor market. And that's still out there, Melody. You got 10 million job openings in June, about 1.3 million more than total unemployed labor force. But we could see a reversal this fall. So I don't know where I'm not confused. It's just all the uncertainty is being drowned out by these self-interested Wall Streeters who are saying what they feel they need to say to move the market in the direction they want.
And it works to some degree.
Yeah, to a large degree,
yeah. Well, it depends on who's saying what.
Well, true, indeed.
But, yeah, you know, especially the Fed. When the Fed speaks, everybody listens. But, yes, you also get there's so much. I don't know if you can actually call it inside trading anymore. I mean, I do. I mean, that's been going on for ages and ages. But, you know, here's something interesting. Your manufacturing activity is 35% below expectations. Now, today's what we just talked about, the retail sales, those numbers came on the heels of yesterday's Empire State Manufacturing Survey, and that wasn't a good survey. It showed a sharp deceleration in factory activity growth in New York. And this is important because a slowdown could signal a reaction to the growing spread of the pandemic and what the governments do and the lockdowns and so forth. And activity in New York generally moves in tandem with most of the other regions of the U.S. We talked yesterday about L.A. copying New York, some of their mandates that they're trying to instill. The Empire Survey is the first of a series of monthly manufacturing reports published by the regional Federal Reserve banks. Now, the August surveys are of particular interest because they occurred amid a spike in the infections, the impact of which was not fully captured in the July economic report. So if you missed yesterday's program, the survey's general business conditions index plunged to 18.3 in August from 43 in July. Now, that's a positive number signal growth, but this drop still represents a steep slowdown in activity, Dave.
Yeah, good point, Melody. I mean, August was a lot worse than the 28 that was expected by economists. In fact, 35% lower, as you mentioned. I mean, the shipments, employment, new orders indexes all deteriorated significantly as well. One Wall Street bank economist observed, the weakening in the Empire State Survey data in August could have been some payback from the very strong July data. Now,
35%, yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, for a more up-to-date reading on manufacturing activity, the Philadelphia Fed's survey will be released on Thursday, the Richmond Fed's next Tuesday, Kansas City next Thursday, and the Dallas Fed's on August 30th. So there's a lot more to come. And then on top of that, right, as we turn the page on another month, we'll get the full month of August consumer sentiment. And I think altogether we'll see how that is all playing. Now, you know, the consumer sentiment, again, which we'll talk about in the third segment, isn't an actual reading, but it often foretells, is a self-fulfilling prophecy of what's ahead. And that's all I'll say about that, Melody.
Well, you know, it's... Because there's, again, how many times have we talked about the conflicting information that we get on these reports? And here's just another example of the mixed signals we get all the time, and that's the factory production. And we know why they do it. We know why we get the mixed signals. We understand that. And,
they're not trying to confuse us, you're not suggesting, are you?
No, they're just flat out. Well, they'll do anything to do, you know, just kind of, if there's a bad report, they'll do something to offset it, and so all the Wall Streeters have something positive to talk about. The Fed's latest report, factory production in July, posted the strongest gain in 4 months, reflecting a surge in production at auto plants that are still wrestling with major supply chain problems. Manufacturing output increased 1.4% last month. Now, that was following a decline in June, and it's the best showing since the 3.4% gain in March. So overall industrial production, which includes manufacturing, utilities, mining, posted a 0.9% increase. And, of course, that's the best performance since a 2.8% surge in March. So the mining sector, that includes your oil and gas production, rose 1.2%. We have producers ramping up production in response to some rising prices for crude oil. Let's see if there's anything else kind of interesting in that. About half of the 1.4% gain in the manufacturing output came from an 11.2% rise in the productions of autos, motor vehicles, and parts. So,
well, you know, and yet the Fed says, Melody, that auto production continues to be constrained by a persistent shortage of computer chips. So if, you know, you take the 11% rise as gospel, and you are sympathetic to the Fed view that there's a lot of constrainment still going on, then you got to believe that there's a long way to go for auto production and parts to come back. So, again, it's perplexing when you've got the Empire Manufacturing Survey on the one hand showing the drop, and now you got the Fed report showing just the opposite. What to believe, where to go, what to expect. This, I might add, is another reason why you should have more than an ample amount of your portfolio invested in gold and silver. And let it sit, because that way you're not, well, hopefully you're less worried, you're less concerned about all of this noise. And it's this noise, ladies and gentlemen, that is causing, and it varies, obviously, the volatility in the different markets, but I'm referring now to the paper markets. The increased the days in which there's, you know, a big jump in volatility, so much of it is noise, and it's with gold, you've got the fundamentals, and that's why, you know, it's so important. And we're not talking about 5 or 10%. Again, we're not financial planners. You should talk to yours if you have one, or make an informed decision. We'll help you with that education. But, you know, I just read an article the other day, Melody, that said 30%, this Egyptian billionaire, suggested a starting point should be a 30% allocation to just gold. And if you read a longer essay that I forget the fellow's name, the essay that he wrote some time ago. I mean, he's talking about a minimum of 50% with your precious metals. So obviously you're the captain of your own fate. Just make sure you steer the wheel, because there are just lots and lots of icebergs just underneath the surface that are waiting to chew you up.
Well, you know, there was is his name Palantir?
Yes.
The CEO of Palantir Technologies, Alexander Karp.
Mm-hmm.
He just bought $50 million in gold bars in August.
Good for him.
Pardon?
Good for him.
Yeah, the company disclosed in its latest earnings statement. And and he's a tech guy. So, you know, I mean, I don't know how many millions of dollars he has, or if he's a billion. I'm assuming he's a billionaire. So $50 million might be a small to him. However, it's big for the gold market.
Yeah.
You know, and when you have those kind of buys, you know, they have the ability to force the prices lower. Maybe that's what we've been seeing. You know, seeing the prices pushed lower so these guys can buy it up. I mean, we know China does it all the time. So someone with the power of a large corporation and you know, the connections in the business arena, the Wall Street, they can keep the prices low for these guys to buy $50 million worth. So it does mean something. And again, maybe that's why we've seen pressure. And I didn't hear the music. We're going into break. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen.
Gold and Silver Trading's Financial Survival. This is Dave Allen. I'm co-hosting with Melody Cederstrom, who's joining us via phone today. Connection issues with hearing our lead-in music. Melody, it's the second segment.
Yes, it is. Well, we had an interesting break. I want to welcome everybody to the second program, and make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com, and sign up for our weekly newsletter and give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. During the break, we're going to talk about the Taliban could have access to that $9.4 billion in reserves in Afghanistan. And I was telling Dave through the break that the head guy now of the Taliban that's ruling and leading the Taliban is one of the five prisoners that Obama let go in a swap. So we could get the guy back who deserted his post. Was it Bergman? Dave.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah, that Daniel.
I'd have to look it up. I'm just going from my memory. We traded those five prisoners for Bergman that deserted his post, and people died, and now you have one of them leading this Taliban that was able to take over the country of Afghanistan with help, I'm sure, but in hours?
Yeah.
I mean, it really is sad. It's nothing to laugh at. And the people of the United States were told that this head guy, I don't know his name off the top, but that he would never be involved in the Taliban or any type of terrorism. So just another lie told to the American people from those that are in charge. So, but the central bank, the Afghanistan bank, held roughly $9.4 billion in international reserves as of mid-April. Now, this was all according to the IMF. What could the Taliban do with that kind of money? And the vast majority of the Afghan central bank assets are said not to be held in Afghanistan. And that's from one intelligence analyst, but who knows, Dave?
Yeah, it's an interesting development. One administration official said any central bank assets the Afghan government has in the U.S. will not be made available to the Taliban. Now, $9.4 billion in general isn't a whole lot of money these days as far as central bank reserves go. However, as Melody said, $9.4 billion in the hands of a group of folks like these Taliban warriors could be used for a lot of shenanigans in Afghanistan and around the world. Now, we know central banks usually hold reserves in gold or a widely held currency like the U.S. dollar. They're generally used for transactions, mainly short-term loans, from one central bank to another.
But so yeah, it's kind of interesting, and of course, you know, it really is sad what we've seen over there. The photos of these folks running alongside of, you know, the U.S. Air Force C-17 transport plane as it took off. I've seen pictures of, you know, the cargo planes. They just had the I don't know what you call it, the loading dock lowered, and all of those people that you see the picture, and they just rushed. I mean, they weren't even scheduled to be in there. They just rushed in there. And I think there was like 640 of them in that cargo holding area on one of the U.S. planes. And my question is, don't they have COVID over there too? Gee, I don't see anybody wearing masks over there, but kind of interesting. You know, if they don't have it, it kind of makes you wonder why. But anyway, it's a sad situation, and it was a poor withdrawal of our troops. And so we'll see where it goes, Dave.
Yes, we will.
Anything you'd like to say?
No. No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's interesting. I don't know if for those who don't know this, TV viewership likely to be humming tonight and tomorrow. President Biden sits down with ABC's George Stephanopoulos. Actually, it's happening today. Be aired on Good Morning America tomorrow between 7 and 9 a.m. Eastern time. Then tonight at 9 Eastern time, Fox News' Sean Hannity interviews former President Trump, talk about Afghanistan and other topics. So I'm sure tomorrow's news shows will be beaming with those highlights, Melody.
Oh, can't wait.
Good day to watch a movie or sports.
Yeah. I guess it'll be Netflix for sure.
Yeah. And to listen to Financial Survival.
Of course. Well, you know, there's credit scores. It's kind of important in today's world. And it's an indicator of financial health, especially in the eyes of lenders who have the ability to extend credit. And this world evolves and lives for people to get credit, to have credit available for whether it's a home mortgage or a car loan or a business. And while you may have several different credit scores because there are a few different types of scoring models, the FICO score is known as the most important one because it gets used in about 90% of the lending decisions. Therefore, it is important to make sure you take steps to keep your score in a healthy range. And good credit is usually to be about 670 and above. Remember what happened in 2008. It had all those subprime loans. So if this isn't the same, 670 isn't the same as if you're breathing, you can get a loan. But the good news is the average FICO score in the U.S. actually increased 8 points to 716 in the past year. That seems like a little bit better indicator that maybe Americans are trying to improve their chance of qualifying for these better loan rates that we have now, maybe for some better credit cards and maybe even some more favorable terms for their mortgages. And again, loans are not a good thing. It's not good to be in debt. And so, because people can get behind and get in trouble. So maybe that I don't know, maybe. I'm sure it has to have a lot to do with the stimulus, because I'm sure everything connects to that to some degree. But I see commercials on TV, Dave, that says if you do this and this and that, you can increase your credit scores by a few points. I wonder if that could actually be going on. Is that possible?
Yeah. In this world, Melody, anything's possible.
I know. breathing and increase your FICO score. Anyway.
There you go. That's right. Yeah, I mean, make sure if you are in debt, make sure you pay on time. Set all your payments up automatically before the due date on or before, preferably before, in case there's a problem with the internet the day your bank tries to send the money. I mean, as of April, only 15% of Americans have had a missing payment that was more than 30 days past its due date this year. Let's see, it was about 20% last year. But remember, payment history accounts for 35% of your FICO score. So it's a big deal. Next, decrease the amount of debt you're carrying. And although millions of people experienced a partial or total loss of income as a result of the pandemic, some of these cash benefits help the people to either pay down some debt or save a little bit more. Beyond the, use for getting through daily life. And third, people are decreasing the amount of how often they're actively seeking out new credit. In other words, fewer Americans have been applying for new lines of credit. In fact, the average number of hard credit inquiries on a person's credit file has decreased by about 12%. So those are just three basic but very important things you can do to improve your credit score, Melody.
Yes. Well, you know, it's Sunday marked the 50th anniversary of our fiat currency. Yes, gold was confiscated in 1933, and they took silver out of our coinage in 1964. But it was in 1971 where I guess you would say was the birth of our fiat currency. And
at least, yeah, you know, the fiat currency pegged to gold.
Pegged to the
gold standard.
Yes. Thank you.
No, that's okay.
I think I probably said that 100 million times over the past 26 years, but the almighty dollar.
We read each other's minds on this program.
Huh?
We read each other's minds on this program.
We do.
As listeners know.
The almighty dollar is facing, we've talked about this all the time, the challenges from other currencies, you know, the powerhouses like China, even the giant technology companies that understand that they would exercise even more market clout if they controlled not just what we buy and sell, but also how we pay for it. Out of Bloomberg, Karen Petro says, if the Fed doesn't quickly redefine the dollar, well, she's talking about digital currency. But the whole point is they want the Fed to redefine the dollar. It is losing its value. And it talks about that the Fed, if they don't do it soon, is going to join, here's her quote, shopping malls on the long list of complacent category killers felled by the agile competitors. And she argues that when, not if, the Fed designs a U.S. central bank digital currency, it must focus not only on its own concerns, including how it would impact monetary policy, but also ensuring that the CBDC is money that materially improves economic output.
Yeah, you know, and we're back to this question. On the one hand, will the Fed, will the U.S., create its own central bank digital currency and, you know, keep up with the rest of the world that particularly, you know, China, as you mentioned, Melody. And by not doing so or by lagging too far behind, does it put us at a competitive disadvantage? Well, time will tell. But the one thing, you know, and I'm not, I mean, just in theory, I think it's a matter of practicality. We'll probably end up going down that road. But, you know, as a philosophical matter, I think Petro, I think she's resigned to that reality, too. And thus she's saying, you know, well, if you're going to go down that route, then use it to promote more equity. And so, I mean, she says this does not and must not mean manipulating a digital dollar's value to advantage one group over another. It just means that digital dollars have to be a truly neutral transmitter of value.
How would it not?
Kind of like gold, Melody? I don't know. Although Jerome Powell disputes any of the risks digitalization poses to the dollar as both fiat and the primary global reserve currency, the Fed is beginning to prepare for this assault. And while work is mostly secretly underway, nothing said by Fed officials so far indicates any awareness about the importance of a CBDC's design beyond just the Fed and the banking system. In fact, this fascinated me enough to the point that I'll be writing more about this topic and discussing why returning to the gold standard may not be such a far-out idea after all. That coming in this Friday's blog, Melody.
All right, well, I'll be looking forward for that, or forward to that. So here's something interesting. The rate of incarcerations in the U.S. fell in 2019 to its lowest levels in over 25 years.
Wow.
But yet it's still the highest rate of imprisonment in the world. This comes
before
from the Pew
the
Research.
Pandemic. Wow.
Pardon? 2019, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I wonder what it is for 2020. According to the new Pew Research Center study, at the end of 2019, the U.S. had 810 people incarcerated in jail or prison for every 100,000 people age 18 and up, amounting to 2.1 million people behind bars. And that last figure, the last time that figure was that low was in 1995. It peaked between 2006 and 2008 at 1,000 incarcerated people per 100,000 people. So we've seen that rate drop every year since. The data doesn't account for incarcerated youth, those that are under 18. And on any given day, there are at least 60,000 minors imprisoned in the U.S. in some states.
Wow.
And the youth incarceration rate is more than 400 per 100,000 people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hopefully they're all at least separated in their own unit. I'm not sure what consolation that is, but...
And I wonder what the real number is that we continue to see so many of them released, let go, various states letting them, you know, just trying to lower those that are incarcerated. So I wonder what the real numbers truly are.
Yeah, right.
Here's the music. We're out of time. I heard it this time. Yay. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Time to financial survival. I'm Dave Allen. Melody off this segment in the office. Call her at 1-800-375-4188. 800-375-4188. Our latest American Survival newsletter, again, has hit the streets. You can sign up for our free weekly newsletters and blogs at dgscoins.com. DGScoins, one word, .com. My article in this week's edition is called Falling Consumer Sentiment is Bad for the Economy, but is Good for Gold. In a further signal that the U.S. economy isn't out of the woods, in fact, it's still deeply in them. The widely followed Consumer Sentiment Index that's produced by the University of Michigan shows that consumer sentiment plummeted in early August. Falling sentiment suggests trouble for the economy usually, especially if it means that consumers get tighter with their pocketbooks and trim their spending. Before this month's reading, sentiment more or less had been improving for much of 2021, despite occasional dips. It's clear trend has been upward, particularly as the economy heated up heading into July. And then the Delta-infused head of COVID reared its ugly presence, and infections suddenly spiked up and continuing to rise in certain parts of the country. According to preliminary August survey results, consumer sentiment plunged nearly 15% from 81.2 in July to 70.2 early August. That beats the lowest level during the pandemic, including last year's 70.8 reading. Indeed, the early August level was the lowest reading since December 2011 and was a lot worse than the 81 expected by economists. Okay, so this month's number still isn't anywhere close to its low during and after the Great Recession. That's all 55.3 in November 2008, 55.8 in August 2011. But an 11-year low isn't anything to write home about or to gift wrap and give your spouse for her or his birthday. So, what is the Consumer Sentiment Index anyway? It's officially called the Survey of Consumers. And why is it so closely followed by economists and investors alike? Well, according to the survey's website, the surveys have long stressed the important influence of consumer spending and saving decisions in determining the course of the national economy. Survey consumers have proven to be an accurate indicator of the future course of the overall economy. It notes, too, that the Index of Consumer Expectations, produced by the surveys of consumers, included in the leading indicator composite index published by the U.S. Department of Commerce's Bureau of Economic Analysis. It says, quote, the inclusion of data from the survey of consumers is a significant confirmation of its capabilities for understanding and forecasting changes in the national economy. Each of the series included in the leading indicators composite index is selected just because of its performance on these six important characteristics: economic significance, statistical adequacy, consistency of timing at business cycle peaks and troughs, conformity to business expansions and contractions, smoothness, and prompt availability. Now, the Index of Consumer Expectations focuses on these three things: how consumers view prospects for their own financial situation, how they view prospects for the economy over the near term, and their view of the economy's prospects over the long term. The Consumer Expectations Index, that is the long-term expectations, dropped almost 14 points to 65.2 in early August, while the Current Economic Conditions Index fell 6.6 points to 77.9. Now, another reason we follow this survey is to better understand investor and consumer expectations and behaviors. For instance, the response of consumers to the sudden plunge in the stock markets in October 1987 highlighted the importance of consumer expectations. It also suggested that consumer reactions could be different, in fact, a lot different than many analysts expect in any given situation. Following the 87 crash, the most presumed judgment was that consumer confidence would play an important role in determining whether a recession would come next. The surprise was that the fear and panic on Wall Street did not spread to Main Street, at least not to a substantial degree. Consumers had a more restrained response, gauging the impact on their own financial situation as limited and the overall effect of the crash as unlikely to spread and bring down the entire economy. Again, from the survey website, quote, "Economic optimism promotes consumer confidence and a willingness to make large expenditures and debt commitments. Economic uncertainty, on the other hand, breeds pessimism and a desire to curtail expenditures and rebuild financial reserves. When many people change from an optimistic to a pessimistic view of economic prospects at the same time, it's been repeatedly found that a widespread shift toward postponement of expenditures follows. Result? And there goes GDP. It's in this manner that the economic optimism and confidence of individual families exert their influence on the course of the aggregate economy." Excuse me. Now, of the August index numbers, CIBC Private Wealth CIO David Donabedian says, "It's just one data point, but it's sobering. It reinforces our expectations of higher market volatility over the course of the year." Remember that, ladies and gentlemen. But Richard Curtin, the survey's chief economist, believes that a huge surge in negative economic assessments also reflects an emotional response, mainly from dashed hopes that the pandemic would soon end. Not sure what he's getting at there, but it's food for thought. From an economic perspective, emotions aren't as impactful as the actual job gains, actual wage gains, actual investment gains that consumers have been experiencing. WIT, ING economist James Knightley says, "Sentiment has given misleading signals on spending before, and we think it will do it again this time. Besides, as Sam Rowe of Axios currently observes, what consumers say or feel doesn't necessarily match what they do. In fact, early evidence from second quarter corporate earnings calls and credit card data suggests that recent consumer spending activity has actually been relatively stable. To be sure, government-mandated restrictions, particularly renewed shutdowns, would be bad for future activity. But Knightley adds, we're also highly doubtful that we will see new lockdowns happen in the U.S., given high vaccination numbers that continue to rise. And I'd say because of the divisive politics such mandates bring. The July retail sales report, which was released earlier today, shows an early read on how the Delta variant's impact on spending actually started last month. Well, regardless of its start date, the economy, ladies and gentlemen, is in for a rough ride. Protect yourselves. Buy gold and silver. Hold on tight. The roller coaster is starting again. Okay, now to move on. I'm not going to apologize. I can't help it. I just can't stay away from Pam and Russ Martin's Wall Street on Parade. In addition, today they report that President Biden's tapping insiders from the New York Fed for key financial roles. It's not a good thing. The swamp, I don't know what to say, how to characterize it at this part. This particular story is disconcerting. It's instructive that these particular insiders have played key roles during the financial crash of 2008 and or the repo loan crisis in the fall of 2019 and or the pandemic-related financial crisis last year. One of them was even around for all three. First, remember this, though. A little background. Remember that the Federal Reserve Board of Governors is an independent federal agency whose board members are appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. But, and it's a big but, and a lot of people forget this, the 12 regional Fed banks that are a part of the Federal Reserve System, they're owned outright by commercial banks, thus making these Fed banks private entities. Now, the New York Fed, the largest of them, stands out because it's owned by some of the largest and most dangerous mega banks, or as the Martins say, Franken banks. I love that term. It's also happened to be some of the largest federally insured banks in America. And as the Martins say, this makes the New York Fed the epicenter of the concept too big to fail. Now, in terms of the New York Fed's power, listen to this. The 12 regional Fed banks had a combined $647,500,000 plus shares of capital stock outstanding as of 12/31/2020. Say that again, $647,500,000. Now, of that amount, about 217,600,000, is that about a third, were controlled by the banks that own the New York Fed. That's more shares than it controlled by the Atlanta, Boston, Chicago, Dallas, Philadelphia, Kansas City, Minneapolis, and St. Louis Fed combined. The largest share owners of the New York Fed, we've mentioned this before, well, too big to fail, J.P. Morgan Chase, the largest U.S. bank, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and the Bank of New York Mellon. And, of course, those same five megabanks are also supervised by the New York Fed, despite participating in the election of two-thirds of its board of directors. No conflict of interest, you say? These same Franken banks also participate in a litany of advisory groups at the New York Fed that determine best practices for the entire industry. Of course, those best practices were clearly not enough to stop J.P. Morgan Chase from becoming a five-count felon, or to keep Citigroup from becoming a financial basket case in the 2008 Wall Street collapse. And they didn't prevent all of the megabanks from creating and selling subprime investments and toxic derivatives that blew up Wall Street and launched the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression, costing millions of innocent Americans their jobs and their homes. Now, having an entity owned by mega Wall Street banks that also supervises the same banks, that's also empowered to create electronic money out of thin air to bail out the banks with no spending limits, sounds like something out of an Orwellian novel, the Martins write. Well, it's not by any stretch. It's real life 1984 stuff in action. Oh, jeez. And don't forget that the Fed's balance sheet has grown from $924 billion in 2007 to over $8.3 trillion today, with American taxpayers, not the banks themselves, on the hook for 98% of that total if things go wrong again. So against that backdrop, we find it a little more than unnerving that someone is whispering in Biden's ear to tap folks from the New York Fed for key slots in his administration. The New York Fed's apparently not yet recognized that Dalip Singh, its executive VP and head of its market group that operates its own trading floor in the New York Fed, has moved on to become President Biden's deputy national security advisor. In fact, as of this morning, the Martins say the New York Fed still had Singh listed as employed at the New York Fed. Wow, talk about the revolving doors being stuck. Oh, man. According to the New York Fed website, this was Singh's job description at the Fed. Among other things, he oversees the group's full portfolio, monitoring and analyzing global financial market developments and providing financial services for foreign in international monetary authorities. Fittingly, Singh was first interviewed in his new job at the G7 summit in June. Then, last Tuesday, the White House announced that Joshua Frost had been selected by Biden to become Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Financial Markets. Frost, who's worked at the New York Fed for more than two decades, also comes out of the market group. Frost apparently already moved to an unannounced role to Treasury earlier this year. His name showed up in Treasury meeting notes in May. It goes on and on and on, but we'll stop here because we're just out of time. Thank you, Martins, for your important work and shedding some sunshine on these important D.C. machinations. That's all the time we have. I'll return on Thursday. Butch will join Melody tomorrow with my Wendy Wilson. Apothecary Herbs. Thanks to our producer and engineer, Todd, as always. I'm Dave Allen. Thanks for listening to Financial Survival, and please be safe out there. Bye-bye.